Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Bob Tice, an architect familiar with natural building and permaculture from Northern California. Mr. Tice was recommended to me by Todd on the Facebook page for the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. In doing the background research to prepare for the episode, I was excited to see that Mr. Tice worked with and learned from Christopher Alexander, the person perhaps most cited for the development of the idea of a pattern language as we now understand it. But that's only part of Mr. Tice's story. He is also steeped in an understanding of permaculture, having studied this discipline with Bill Mollison. The storytelling and aesthetics that allow for the creation of art and shared experience required for the creation of civilization, that we might rise above subsistence and survival, comes through in Mr. Tice's words and the way he composes tales that build an emotional resonance while answering my questions. I connected with what he said and am thankful to provide a space for him to elaborate on his ideas, even if we didn't cover as many of the topics as I originally planned. So in this episode, we cover his background, creating emotional appeal through natural building, the role of a designer or architect to provide insight to their customers, and the dignity of labor. As you'll hear, I want to have him back on the show in the future so we can cover some of the more technical aspects of natural building and design, methods, and materials. And this podcast is made possible by you, the listeners. Please consider making a donation to the show to help get the word about permaculture out to more people. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Bob Tice. I'll join you again afterwards with some more thoughts. Well then, Mr. Tice, if you're ready, if you could give us your background and how you came to permaculture and all the work that you're doing, and we can take it from there.
Well, let's see. I was a practicing architect for 20 years or so before I took my first permaculture course. I had heard about permaculture from several of the people in the natural building community that I had worked with, and I was fortunate that I believe it was the last time that Bill Mollison actually came and gave a full seminar was the time I signed up for it. My first time with him, unfortunately, I got sick. Well, I came back from a trip to Mongolia, a consultation in Mongolia, sick, and so I was only able to get through some of the days of the first course I had with him. But he came back for another one, and I completed the course, if you will, with him after that. And subsequently made enough connections with the permaculture network that permaculture work has become integral to what I do. However, a great deal of my work is not out in the countryside where you have the command of the landscape that you normally associate with permaculture. A great deal of it is in metropolitan areas. And although Bill Mollison talks a great deal about permaculture in the city, this is something that is still a very, very nascent field in my experience. We're only beginning to get a grasp of the devices and invisible networks and so on that are necessary for permaculture in an urban setting to really work, because you don't have command over the property in the way that you do when you're doing permaculture out in the country. And so it's really interesting to watch it slowly become a reality in all manner of different directions. But the food producing aspect is just beginning to be touched on now. And interestingly enough, one of the most driven areas of permaculture in the urban landscape is not food production, although that's happening. It's actually decreasing the runoff urban situations that is driving a great deal of the greenscaping of the urban landscape. So that's an interesting thing to happen. It's one of the paradoxes, is that change very often comes from a direction that you don't expect. What else? I had already been involved in straw bale construction before I got involved in permaculture. That's what I was doing in Mongolia. I was aid agency sponsored me to come out and talk to the government agencies in Mongolia about the attributes of straw bale construction. Their country representative correctly identified it as a perfect technological match for the country. They grow wheat. They have the world's coldest climate. They bale things, although with old Russian balers that don't give you very good bales. So I was out there as the visiting suit, basically, to say, yes, Western professionals say that straw bale construction is viable. And although we made a very bad strategic error by building our first two straw bale demonstration houses in the barrios of the capital, Ulaanbaatar, and thus stigmatizing straw bale construction as poor people's construction. In retrospect, we should have built one for a rock star or something. I have since heard that it was a successful technology transfer and that straw bale construction is actually doing quite well in Mongolia. So that's good to hear. And straw bale construction is something of a leading edge, what do they call it, gateway drug to natural building in a lot of ways, because it comes off the back of a truck, is basically rectilinear in nature, and so it's a fairly easy substitute for people who aren't looking to be ecological pioneers and demonstrate a house that is radically different from that of their neighbors. In fact, you can do a house that looks very much like your neighbor's with straw bale construction, which is what most people would prefer to do. And yet, straw bale construction, once you sign on to straw bale construction, you start to realize that a great deal of conventional construction, what you do with conventional construction, is better addressed with things that are actually more natural in character. And a great example of that is our progress in plastering straw bale buildings. My first building, which was done in 1991, it was like the second straw bale building to get a permit in the state of California. We did cement stucco because that's what we knew on the outside of the building, and only later realized that lime plaster was a great, much better match to straw bale construction than cement plasters were. And so we had to learn about lime plasters because that technology had been lost in this country. And then as we progressed, we realized that earth plasters were an even better match for straw bale construction, vis-a-vis the breathability of the walls, which when you get into super insulated construction becomes a primary concern. And there again, we had to kind of reinvent or relearn how to do proper earth plasters. And so it's a great example of once you start listening to what your materials would prefer to be doing, you get led into areas of natural building that you wouldn't particularly expect to get into. There the driving force actually is not technological concerns like vapor transfer and so on. The primary driver in that realm is actually the delight that the building engenders. And this is something that I'm often cautioning people. We tend in the building industry to be kind of technologically oriented, that we address things in terms of their proper functioning and so on. And I'm always pointing out to people that there are no coffee table books about the beauty of rostra block homes or other super insulated ways of building. While there are in straw bale construction, straw bale construction's primary driver is not its super insulation or its low embodied energy. Straw bale's fundamental driver is the delight that the thick informal walls create. And so I'm often cautioning people that don't get their heads too wrapped up in the technological about these things, because that's not what has really fueled the straw bale revival. And the same is true of a lot of other things. You know, as we concern ourselves with making our buildings more energy efficient and zero carbon and or carbon neutral and so on, it's very, very easy to get your head lost in some technological determinism, when the important thing to do, if you're really going to be serious about these changes happening as quickly as they need to happen, is to pay closest attention to the delight of it, because that's what really gets people's juices going.
They get an emotional attachment to the building and the way that it feels when they enter it and the way that it looks?
Yeah, fundamentally, The way I put it is that what you want to be able to do is have people walk into the building and say, this is gorgeous, I want it. Oh, it's energy efficient? I want energy efficiency. I mean, I used to joke, but it's actually based on real experience. When I did my first draw the building, I got some press for it, you know, written up in Fine Home Building and Sunset Magazine and even the Wall Street Journal. And so there were people coming in. This was before we had any of those coffee table books on Strawbale. They'd come in just with these little newspaper clippings and things. And the couple would sit down, and the husband would say, yeah, well, we're going to build a house, and we think the energy efficiency of Strawbale construction makes a lot of sense. And the wife would say, oh, come on, I saw this picture, and I told him, I want to build a house this way. The husband had permission to go with something as unusual as Strawbale because of its resource efficiency or energy efficiency, you know, sort of, you had left brain permission to go with it, but it was really a right brain response that brought them into the office. So that's the most important thing, I think, to bear in mind, is that all of this natural building and even permaculture and other elements like that tend to try to address people in left-brain terms when what they really want to be spoken to is the delight of the environment. You know, we are so tired of, quote, efficient buildings with perfectly flat walls that have no character to them. We want an environment around us fundamentally where we can enjoy the stories that the building represents. So in the same way that it's so much more delightful to have a cucumber where you have met the farmer because you went to the farmer's market and learned about, you know, a little bit about what he does, when you know the farmer that the straw in your walls came from, and you know the barrow pit where the earth that became the plaster on your walls came from, and so on. When your building engenders that kind of stories, not only does it have walls, you know, whose texture has appealed to you, but underneath all of that visual nutrition or sensory nutrition, there are actually stories to the building that fill a deep need in our brain. We seem to think in terms of stories far more readily than we do just abstract technical determinants.
With natural building, because it's still in many ways kind of a nascent profession, or I don't know. No, I feel like that's kind of demeaning to that term.
No, I mean, when you consider, although it's grown really explosively, when you consider the amount of building done in this country, yes, it's still quite nascent in its relation to the rest of the building in the country. Yeah.
Moving forward with that thought then, since I'm not too far off base, do you think that it's because it's still small scale allows for more of a personal connection between the people who are building these homes and where these materials are coming from and the people they're working with?
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. I mean, a good example of the scaling up of natural construction is that there are now nationwide earth plaster companies, whereas previously you had to go out and find a good clay that you could make into an earth plaster on your walls, you know, source it and dig it and sift it and so on. Now you can actually go to the store and buy an earth plaster by the bag, you know, with the color mixed in already and so on. And so, yeah, it is starting to undergo that transition. And as I said, one of the reasons that Strawbale construction has taken off as quickly as it has is because the straw bales are something of a packaged commodity. You know, it comes off the back of a truck. The way I say it is, natural building is moving from the phase of everything being custom to some of the things being industrialized, but it's still at the stage where the equivalent would be, say you wanted to build a wood frame house and you took the carpenters out to a wood lot and waved at the trees and said, okay, here's the wood for the project. And they had to cut them down and season them and cut them into 2x4s and so on and so forth. You know, it's a whole different skill level required, knowing the entire process of the material from how it leaves the natural environment until it finally goes into your building that has to be known to do natural building. Whereas all of our standard kinds of construction, all you need to know is how to put together the stuff that arrives from on the truck. And so, you know, two very different sets of skills and two very different sets of orientations as well. And so it's going to be interesting to watch whether natural building in general industrializes to the point where somebody who doesn't know the entire life cycle of the material is able to really be part of the building. I mean, in some ways, the subset of natural building of earth plasters has already made that leap, because earth plastering doesn't require a cob or straw building as a substrate. You can have a conventionally built building as a substrate for your plaster. You see earth plasters and things like that moving far more broadly into the built environment in general terms because of its adaptability to different substrates and so on. And so you now have people whose background is they don't particularly know how to gauge the dirt under their feet, whether it's a good plaster or not, because they simply go to the store and buy a bagged earthen plaster to put on the walls. And so you're seeing some of that industrialization of natural building already happening in a few select little areas of it.
Do you see the industrialization of natural building as a normal progression of this? Is this a place where you'd like to see natural building go so that it becomes more readily available, or do you think that something is lost in the process by doing so?
Yes, of course things get lost in the process of doing it. But the fact of the matter is, most people don't have the time or the resources to ignore the efficiencies of industrialization. That is, even at the starvation rates that your typical natural builders bill at, people don't have the wherewithal for all the materials in their house to be processed by hand. And housing is expensive enough as it is. Even a fully industrialized building is out of the affordability for most people as our economies exist nowadays. And it's kind of interesting that if you know a little bit about the history of construction in this country, about the turn of the last century, you look at the budget of a building, and it was about two-thirds materials and one-third labor. When I was going to school in the 70s, it was about 50-50 materials and labor. And now it's almost exactly reversed. It's about 60% labor, 30 or 40% materials. And so given that direction in things, the natural inclination is to decrease the labor component of the building to reduce its price, which puts the emphasis on how much of your building can be pre-manufactured, because pre-manufacturing is so much more efficient of labor. However, when you do that, you decrease the stories that the building embeds. And so what we're now doing is a really delicate dance in natural building, where we're trying to increase the efficiencies while we still keep the important stories and keep the building as flexible in its materials as possible so that the building can still respond to the unique characteristics of its site and not be a simply one-size-fits-all kind of response like a manufactured home or a trailer that just gets sort of airdropped onto the site no matter, you know, and if you're lucky, its front door is in the right place.
And that speaks to something else that I wanted to talk with you about. You, as I understand, had an opportunity that you studied and worked with Christopher Alexander.
Oh, yes.
And were you then part of the team that helped to develop the pattern language?
No, the pattern language was well before my time. Okay. Yeah, the pattern language, although the pattern language, the book, was what fundamentally got me to go out on my own as an architect in New York City. I was practicing in New York, which is where I went to school originally and got my bachelor's. And I was working in an office there and came across the pattern language in a bookstore and said, wow, the revolution has come. Here is what's going to turn architecture upside down. And I sat back and confidently waited for the revolution to happen in architecture. And unfortunately, I'm still waiting. The architecture profession was not nearly as enamored of the pattern language as I was and a few other people. But I went out on my own as a one-person office in New York City, primarily to put a pattern language into practice. And the office I was working for wasn't interested in doing so. So I was going along happily, working with clients using pattern languages and so on, and then caught wind that Chris Alexander was going to give a seminar at Omega Institute in upstate New York for a week. And so I signed up for that and went up there. And that was in the early 80s. And so Chris, at this seminar, talked about what he'd been doing since the pattern language had come out, because that was easily 10 years before then. And given his background in mathematics, he basically said that while the work represented in the pattern language was necessary for creating environments with really deep feeling, it hadn't proven to be sufficient. That, for example, when he went down to Mexicali and did a cluster of houses down there, what he did with his students to create a builder's yard and try out the building system had more depth of feeling than when the students turned around using the same pattern language and each designed a house for each of the participating families. And so, given his mathematical predilections, he said, okay, this pattern language work really helps, but in and of itself is not sufficient to create the kind of depth that we're really looking for in the built environment. And so he had since been saying, okay, what is this next layer of, this deeper layer of order that is necessary in the situation? And so I came back from the seminar saying, oh boy, I'm not going to wait for the next book to come out, which is a good thing because it was 25 years before that book actually came out. And it's not a book, it's a 4-volume set called The Nature of Order. But anyway, I just came back and I said to my partner, Chris is now bringing architecture to the kind of depth of level that we are experiencing in meditation, our meditation practices and listening to Krishnamurti talk and so on. So it behooves me to go out there and work with the guy. And so it took a few years of pestering because normally his work crews came from his graduate architecture students. And he hadn't really brought in people from the outside world before. But I was one of a number of people from the Omega Institute seminar. I mean, it's really a testament to Chris's appeal that there was something like 200 of us at the Omega Institute seminar. And, God, I haven't counted it, but I believe 12 people picked up and moved to Berkeley to work with Chris Alexander as a result of experiencing him at that seminar. So we were his big experiment in taking working architects, engineers, carpenters, cabinet makers, and seeing whether we could learn his approach on the job rather than as part of a graduate in master's in architecture program. It wasn't terribly successful, unfortunately. And after I had been working with his crews for a year and a half, he said, you know, I've concluded that you actually have to do some classroom study of this work, and it's not just about on-the-job training. So this normal history proceeds by ironies. I come out to California for hands-on experience and end up getting a master's in architecture in hands-on experience. because while I was getting my master's, I was also construction supervisor for a house of Chris's design that was 2 hours north of Berkeley. And so I absolutely fried myself by taking 4 days of classes and then working 3 days on a construction site, supervising graduate students. But it was exactly what I had come to get. You know, I got the experience of having my world turned upside down in terms of design.
And after going through that process, do you agree with his assessment that you needed the classroom in order to make the hands-on experience work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, as a matter of fact, the thing I came away from the experience with is that, for me at least, it was hard, if not impossible, to be the one in charge of the scheduling and the budgeting and the workflow on the site, and also be the one responsible for making, for safeguarding, if you will, the aesthetic intent of the job. The two are just so often at cross purposes that, you know, when you've got the plumber standing there waiting with his hands on his tool belt for you to make a decision about something, and you know, because something has come up and the sink isn't in quite the right place, and you've got to do a few mock-ups to know whether the sink isn't going to be in the right place and so on. And the two sides of your brain are just at war with each other about getting it right versus getting it done. Very, very, very hard thing to do. So that part of it where Chris insists on an absolute integration of the role of architecture and the role of builder, that I'm not so sure about. And as a matter of fact, I haven't kept that role of builder. I will work with contractors on jobs, but I won't take on the role of being the contractor myself, just because when you put on the hard hat part of things, I find the pressure has me giving short shrift to the meaning part of it. And the meaning part of it is fundamentally what people are hiring me for. You know, they are hiring me not particularly for my construction skills. They're hiring me for my insight. And so I have to respect that mandate, if you will. But fortunately, here in Northern California, where I am, we have contractors who are more sensitive to this intent than I've experienced anywhere else in the country, or the world for that matter. You know, when I was in New York, the contractors just seemed to be, just tell me what I need to know to get it done. Whereas here, the contractors I've found are marvelously creative guys. They will come up with things that are more radical than I am suggesting in certain situations. And so it actually works out quite well that once atmosphere of mutual respect is created and I demonstrate that I know the constraints that they're under, we can usually work together quite well. So I'm not unhappy about the fact that the role of getting it built can be delegated to someone else.
You feel comfortable in your position as an architect helping to consult and design on these projects?
And very frequently, there are things on the job that I will assign to myself simply because I know that I would spend more time trying to communicate what I'm after than I would actually just getting it built. So there are things like I will simply designate the plumbing that is going to a recess in a concrete wall, and I just put on the drawing that a fountain is going here. And when we get to that stage, I just go out, hire an assistant, and build the fountain myself, you know, or the ornament around the front door. I will simply say to the plasterer, give me a 12-inch wide band around the door with a scratch coat of plaster on it and leave it at that. And once the plasterer has done all of his work, I go out there and I do the ornamental surround around the door and that kind of thing. I still very much like to actually get my hands dirty and learn about the work. The way I'll put it is that unless you have body knowledge of how the materials go into the building and work with it, you're really at a disadvantage in thinking that you can design with that material. And so it becomes really important if you're going to work with earth plasters that you spend a few days out on the site actually getting the body knowledge of what an earth plaster goes on like, what it can do and what it doesn't do very well, and so on. Getting a physical feel for the materials becomes really important, no matter what the materials are, but particularly when the materials are expected to tell a story and be materials that come from the locale and have a resonance with the environment that you're building in.
You make me think about how my father and grandfather built houses back in the 1960s, and that idea of all that knowledge moving forward, that, you know, I can call my father or my stepfather, who also did home construction and building construction for 20 years, and ask them a question. And because of the holistic way in which they learned their trades, they can answer questions about plumbing, heating systems, cooling systems, you know, how to frame out a doorway, how to put in a window, and all these other pieces of construction that I now, all these years later, am trying to relearn, because I was raised, well, you're going to have a career where you'll make enough money, you're just going to call somebody and they're going to do it for you, and you'll never have to worry about knowing what we know. And trying to get that understanding so that I can learn the next steps of what I'm trying to do when it comes just to home repair or renovation.
It's really quite sad that there used to be a phrase in the early 20th century about the dignity of labor, where it's true that being a carpenter or a mason may not have had all the status of being an academician or a financier or something, but there was still a dignity attached to it. And that has largely been lost, as near as I can see in our culture, that the dignity of an honest manual profession has largely been erased from our culture. That if you have to use your hands to do something, unless you are a recognized artisan of some kind, you know, like, it's not just that you are a plasterer, but that you are a master fresco plasterer. You know, once you were up at the level where you're doing work for museums and billionaires and so on, you gain something in the way of status. I have a friend who's taught me most of what I know about earth plastering, for example. She is now doing a job in San Francisco where they are recreating the caldarium, the hot bath of a Pompeian villa. And she has brought in an Italian plasterer who's one of five existing living plasterers who knows how to do plaster frescoes the way the Romans did. You know, and those sorts of people have a great deal of respect, at least within the building trades, and, you know, the people who know building trades and so on. But your ordinary run-of-the-mill plasterer is in the position now of his level of skill is represented entirely by how absolutely flat and almost machine-made he can make a wall surface. Rather than, you know, can he model a cornice molding? Can he turn a beautifully radiused corner? Because there aren't any radiused corners anymore, and so on. And so I think it's quite sad to my mind that there are so many people who would much, much rather work with their hands and bodies and so on to make a living. You know, this is what they're oriented toward rather than working in abstractions. And as you said, you know, everybody gets nudged or pushed or urged or something toward a profession that is all about abstractions, because that's seen as where the status and the money and so on are. I mean, if you just think how many vocational programs still exist in this country, you know, what are the vocational programs? You look at your local community college and its vocational programs are dental assistant and computer technician, fundamentally. And so, yeah, it's quite sad.
So many of the things that you just said speak to the place that myself and many of my friends find ourselves in. It was that idea of, well, what am I going to do after high school? Well, go to college, get a degree, and then go do, you know, work in an office building as an accountant or, you know, working with computers or something. And I know so many people who went into those kinds of industries, and then it winds up then that their hobbies become very physical, manual things, or they use that precision that's required in their professional lives in a hobby. One that comes to mind is I have a friend who restores antique straight razors. And it's because he loves this old steel that he can handle that's nothing like he can find elsewhere unless he pays a lot of money for it. But because there's this craft to people who are interested in shaving with straight razors, he can find an antique that's from the Civil War era that's a very fine carbon steel and apply all of his technical understanding of these different things and the manufacturers and then take it home and clean it and make it sing when someone puts it to their face to shave with it.
You know, what fun.
Yeah, and I have two of his razors, and I can say that they're a joy to work with, but it's scary to put something like that to your throat and go, ah, so this is why it's a cutthroat razor, because I now have a pocket in my cheek because I did this wrong. Oh, but that's so far removed from natural building. But it's an understanding, though, that like what he moved into to do that was because he was treated as an artisan. He was doing a specialized craft to do this because there weren't many who did. Whereas that plasterer you described, having seen plasterers at work from my old profession, it's amazing to me that they can get a wall that is smooth and flat, but also understanding how easy that plaster wall is to repair relative to drywall and how beautiful the finished product can be.
Yeah, no, I went down to Arizona, 5 months ago for a hands-on seminar with a Japanese master plasterer. And here are some of the most highly skilled plasterers in the world represented by this guy. And because of the way Japan's traditional structures are these post and beams things with plaster infills, the fact of the matter is that there, all of their training is, I shouldn't say all, that's oversimplifying, but the bulk of their training is in getting a plaster surface so smooth you can literally see your face in the reflection, or read a newspaper in the reflection for that matter. And it just struck me as amazing. And I was slightly disappointed, to tell you the truth, that we spent all our time getting the background in how to produce a perfectly flat surface when we can go to Home Depot and buy a perfectly flat surface if that's what we want.
With what you were saying, I think it's about those stories and, if you will, like the cultural differences. As you're working to the emotional appeal for someone and those curves and corners and the place that you come from in wanting that versus necessarily like what the Japanese masters and what their cultural requirements are for that kind of work.
Yeah. I mean, it's very telling that the California Straw Building Association, CASBO, we've been giving workshops in straw bale construction and its associated plastering for at least 10 or 12 years now. And I've taught at quite a few of them. And without exception, the folks who are taking these workshops are your ordinary middle-class folks. I've been mulling in my head about how we might repackage ourselves so that we go out to the Central Valley and start giving workshops to the folks who really need straw bale construction, which are the farm workers and the working class folks who, number one, have the physical endurance, have the bodies to actually get through the entire construction of a house by themselves, but number two, could build a super insulated building for themselves for far less using what we've learned about straw bale construction than if they were just to buy a modular home or their normal economic alternatives. It's part and parcel, I think, of the fact that, you know, once you've made your middle-class life for yourself and you've established, you know, that you're sort of materially comfortable, and so on, then you start saying, okay, but what about the part of me that isn't satisfied with just bringing in the bacon by pushing around papers? And that's where all of the market, if you will, really exists for natural building and straw bale building, and to a large extent, permaculture and things like that as well. You know, it's not, I've been part of how many 6-7 permaculture trainings, and you have very, very few farmers or even sons of and daughters of farmers who are taking the permaculture trainings. It's the same sort of ecologically minded middle class folks who are taking the straw bale courses, folks who are, and to my mind, what it's all about is people looking for ways to get the sensory nutrition they require back into their lives.
There's so much that I could say on that, sir, and there's so much more that I'd like to cover with you. Regretfully, we're running towards the end of our time, but it goes so quickly. But with your last thoughts, you brought us back around in some ways to the beginning about permaculture and some of the directions that we're going. In order to wrap things up, do you have any last thoughts on the things that we've covered today to share with the listeners? Because I certainly, looking at the list of other pieces that I'd like to cover with you, I'd love to have at least one or maybe two more conversations with you in the future.
Sure. Well, given the things that I jotted down when you were running through the kinds of things that you wanted to cover, the thing that I say to permaculture folks or folks who say, I really want to build a natural building, but I can't afford 10 acres out in the country and that kind of thing, is the thing I urge people to do, as I say, someplace out in the country doesn't need your attention nearly as much as some ruined piece of property in town somewhere. That the biggest building secret around is that the huge housing and building stock of the mid-century, last century, is fundamentally nearing the end of its economic lifetime. Its roof is worn out, its windows are worn out, and so on. Generally, it still has a good foundation. It's still got all its utilities and so on, but the place is, in economic terms, a write-off. But if you can find one of these buildings, you can strip it down to its studs, rebuild it as an ecological house, and have made an improvement on the landscape rather than taking some gorgeous piece of property and, with the best of intentions, kind of imposed your will upon it. You know, our built fabric needs the attention of permaculture and natural building far more than the unbuilt landscapes surrounding them. And so that's my biggest piece of advice nowadays, is don't wait for something to come on the market when you are competing with everybody else who's hungry for a home. Find the neighborhoods that you really enjoy. And those also should be a neighborhood where you know you can age in place. And there's actually a phenomenon occurring now called NORCs, or naturally occurring retirement communities, where people recognize viable, walkable neighborhoods where they can age in place because there's a drugstore and a transit stop and a supermarket or a food store within walking distance. And the demographics of these neighborhoods are graying because that's who's buying up these houses, because they recognize the economic value of it for them. So find yourself a walkable neighborhood that you love, and then just investigate the fine grain of it until you find some ruined building somewhere and bring that back to life, is my big piece of advice nowadays.
And that leaves a smile on my face for some of the conversations my wife and I have had about what our next step's going to be, because of where we live is so beautiful and we like our neighbors and where we are, but we've thought about moving somewhere else because of the house that we're in and how it was built and some other things, but we can always adapt it over time and make it more of what we want without having to place ourselves somewhere else. I really appreciate that, sir. Thank you. And hopefully the next time we can have a bit more of a technical conversation about some of the materials and choices people can make when they're doing their renovations.
Sure.
Thank you so much for your time with me today.
You're welcome.
And that was Bob Tice. After this interview, I was left with quite a bit on my mind, so this after section is a bit longer than normal. The first of the things that I keep rolling around was the role of personal appeal in natural building, and that we need to connect with the right side of the brain, as that metaphor for the creative and emotional part of ourselves, as a way to make natural building something more mainstream, to reach out to people, and not sell them on the logical pieces, like how much money they'll save on their bills, or that this is a good way to be more resilient, but by telling a story, Just as supporting a farmer by buying direct provides a non-material connection to that person, as we get to know them, it also provides material benefits through economic exchange and the food that we get. And I see that as another bridge between the invisible and the physical, both between ourselves and the people with whom we interact regularly, as well as our permaculture design, clients, students, and others. We can create a desire, something that can't be touched, in someone that leads them to a place where they make a choice or take an action that is in line with the ethics and principles of permaculture, while also giving back something of value. David Holmgren's imperative to implement exemplary design we can use to attract those people who are most interested, and along the way, by building systems that people find appealing, reach ever larger groups than we might otherwise. To appropriate the line from Field of Dreams, if we build it, they will come. That's also why I like Bob's last thought about renovation rather than creating something new. If we choose good neighborhoods with less than great buildings, the places we settle and then restore serve as further examples for people to see and consider emulating. Yes, I have a personal desire for a large stretch of land with a fully integrated design and an off-the-grid, capable home. But if it doesn't add to the body of understanding for others in a visceral way, does it do the most good? Am I better off with a small lot while continuing to buy some of my fruit and veg from the farmer, but in a way that allows me to inspire others? I think so, because of the connection we have and can build with the people that we want to reach. As one of the core ideas expressed in the designer's manual, this is about cooperation rather than competition. So we should work to interact and aid one another and not become a more insular community. And one thing that Bob mentions that I have been struggling with is the accessibility of low-cost building knowledge and information about permaculture into the hands of those who need it. This is something I'll most likely be speaking about more in my review of Ben Falk's book, The Resilient Farm and Homestead. But I think that Bob's comment about seeing middle-class folks come to courses is reflective of the pioneers who are able to afford the time and energy to indulge their interests and invest in this future. If you're living a life just trying to make it from one day to the next, it's hard to think about what's going to come in a week or a month or another year and put in that long-term forecasting that would get you to plant a tree today when that money in your pocket right now can buy you food from the grocery store. Or, if you live in a food desert, just the corner store. For now, I think that those of us who are doing this kind of work professionally need those pioneers to help pave this path forward. They are the ones who can provide the financial capital while learning this information and buying the books, and also have the time to take away from a job to come to classes. And that winds up putting money into the pockets of teachers so that we can spend more time doing this work and reach others. As I'm fond of thinking of it, that's the third ethic in action. Asking those who have a surplus to provide it, and then in a way that frees up others to have surpluses in their own lives to give back to more down the line. If you haven't read it, I really recommend that you check out the article Eight Forms of Capital, written by Ethan Rowland and Gregory Landwa. I'll include a link to it in the show notes. It's worth reviewing and thinking about. But as this happens, as we're sharing our surplus, limiting our consumption so that we have more available to invest in other things, we're getting to a point where this information is being shared in more ways, making it more accessible. There's a wider variety of classes available than ever before. You can find them online or on site, with schedules to fit nearly any lifestyle. Need a weekend only, one day a month, long weekend, 3 or 4 day intensive, 1 week, 2 week, or longer? They're out there. And as teachers work more, the more people know about the classes, the more people sign up and show up for them. And the teachers earn a living and have more flexibility to share with those who need it. And the last point that comes to mind from Mr. Tice's interview is the dignity of labor. Though society may not, at this moment, respect them the way I understand it once did, there's a great deal we must learn in order to appropriately reskill to live comfortably in a more localized community, and that comes from the trades. In being aware of how to build and design and put things together. And there's a quote from Robert Heinlein's Time Enough for Love that I keep coming back to and I think about for our future. And it states, a human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance accounts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyze a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight efficiently, die gallantly. Specialization is for insects. I take from that we should have this kind of competency moving forward to become a jack of all trades and master of one, as suggested by David Holmgren. And I think that it's a viable path. There's a lot we need to accomplish to make all of this work, to make all of this happen. The only way we'll get it done is by taking action ourselves and showing others what they can accomplish once they get started. In order to do that, to take that next step, requires a respect and appreciation for the dignity of labor in ourselves and in others. That thought brings the main part of this episode to a close. If you have feedback for me about this show, you can leave it on the website for this episode at thepermaculturepodcast.com by sending me a message on Twitter, where I am at permaculturecst, or on the Facebook page for the site, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. If you have any questions or want to have a conversation with me, the best way to do that is by email or phone, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call 717-827-6266. And I'm located in Pennsylvania, so if you want to give me a call, I'm usually available between 9:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, Eastern Time, which right now is -4 UTC. Coming up next week, we'll have Eric Olson of Permaculture Artisans. We talk about his work developing a permaculture skills center and also about professional permaculture. On July 9th is Josh Trott of D-Acres. We cover the history of D-Acres and the amount of work that's gone into building it over the years, as well as some of the questions that need answered in order to move forward. On July 16th is Nikki Jabor, author of The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener, and we talk about cool climate gardening, the planning required to eat from the garden in any season, and how we modify our environment to make it happen. For anyone interested in the online PDC, which starts in just a few days on July 1st, 2013, there are a few seats left. Contact me for details, or you can register by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/PDC-registration. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. Oh, and the legal. The Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Feel free to share it. Just tell people where you got it from, and don't sell it or change it.